We are stars. We are golden. We are big.
Just a couple of weeks away from the 40th anniversary of a musical milestone, the Woodstock Music and Arts Festival in upstate New York in the middle of August 1969. I wasn't there, neither was my next guest, but he did write an oral history of Woodstock. In fact, this is the book that started our friendship 20 years ago when he first released his first edition of this book and came on my radio show then to talk about it. And now here, two decades later, on the nearly 40th anniversary, I'm happy to welcome Joel McCower back to the show. Good morning, Joel. How are you?
Good morning, Paul. Great, thanks.
Nice to have you back on the show. I want to read just a little bit from the preface of your book. You say, Woodstock was not a disaster. Far from it. There was much joy in humanity and heroics galore. Starting with a ragtag crew of idealistic and energetic youth, Woodstock essentially was financed and produced by those in their mid-20s to early 30s. The festival staff mushroomed into hundreds of hippies, hucksters, handymen, and hangers-on. As the plans became reality, these people met the troubles they encountered, the weather, drugs, radical politicos, and on, with high levels of ingenuity and integrity. It is ironic, albeit not surprising, that many of those involved likened being at Woodstock having been through a war. That's from Joel's book, Woodstock, The Oral History, which has been re-released, by the way, not just in print, but also as an audiobook you can download on audible.com. Do you think the people who you wrote about in this book would look at it, if we were in the middle of Woodstock right now, do you think they would look around and go, not a disaster, everything's cool?
Well, I think in the real moment of Woodstock, you know, it wasn't really a disaster. There were certainly moments of tension when, if you've seen the movie, the incredible winds and rainstorms that really threatened to bring down the lighting towers and collapse the little infrastructure they actually had. But when you step back and look at it, you know, this should have been a disaster. I mean, the story of Woodstock, it really... You know, these four guys who were 23, 25 wanted to build a recording studio in the town of Woodstock in upstate New York, and they decided finally through a long negotiated process that they'd actually have a festival, and the proceeds, the profits from the festival would go to build a recording studio. They couldn't find the land to have this. They finally found a place, but about 35 days before the festival, they were thrown off the land by the townspeople. And so they had 35 days to find Yasgur's farm. Max Yasgur has a dairy farm, alfalfa and dairy farm, and to build this thing. And they never really finished. You know, they didn't have the gates and the fences and a lot of the stuff. And of course, they didn't expect the crowds they expected. So these people were coming. Traffic was paralyzed. The National Guard and the Army got involved. Every church and hospital and everything was involved. And it rained and poured, and it was already muddy from, extremely wet summer, and people were unprepared, and there were drugs, and people didn't have their medicine, and they weren't prepared to sleep overnight. There wasn't enough food and toilets and everything else. It should have been a disaster, and so the fact that it wasn't is kind of what the book is about, and it really speaks to who we were in 1969 and the sensibilities, the humanity, the politics, the culture, the business sense. It's really a fascinating story.
It really is. I'm curious because you talk about all the people who showed up there, many of whom, most of whom were not expected by the organizers of the event. Now, here we are. We're talking on the big news talk radio station in Seattle with a huge number of listeners. And even to add on top of that, I just tweeted that you were going to be on my show today. So people who follow me on Twitter at Paul Harris Show, who may not have been listening, now know that you're on with me, and so we can spread the word about that. Plus, I've got a website, as you do, WoodstockOralHistory.com. So there are a lot of different ways to get the word out about lots of things now in the 21st century.
Right.
40 years ago, there was no Twitter. There were no social networks. There was no online. How did 500,000 people find a farm in upstate New York or even decide to go there in the first place?
Well, I'll tell you a quick story in a second, but just so you understand what I did here, in an oral history, a lot of times the legendary Studs Terkel would tell a series, Paul would tell his story and Joel would tell his story, and it would be just a series of stories. But what I did is I interviewed about 70 people, producers and performers and doctors and cops and kids in the audience and Mrs. Yasger and Abby Hoff and Wavy Gravy. And the story comes together sort of like they're all sitting in a big living room telling it together. So it's kind of like you do a movie and cut it together into one seamless thing. And so one piece of that are some of the kids who went. And one example is a woman named Diana Warshawski, who happens to be my sister. Now, Diana was living in 1969. She was 22 years old. Was living in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury. And she didn't watch television, listen to radio, have newspapers or magazines or any media whatsoever. But she heard on the street that there was some kind of big music event happening in a place called Woodstock, and it had something to do with a ranch owned by Bob Dylan. Now, that's simply not even close. Dylan wasn't there. He doesn't have a ranch. It was nothing of the sort there. And based on that information, that was sufficient for her to go out to Interstate 80 and stick out her thumb. And she hitchhiked cross-country. That's one story. I mean, there's, you know, stories of people who saw an ad in the back of a magazine that was sort of a lefty magazine at the time called Ramparts or in the Village Voice or somewhere, something else. And, you know, but it was just this network. I mean, there was, you know, social networking at the time was really social. People were either, they'd put up posters, you'd see flyers on telephone poles. There were all kinds of, you know, gatherings and events and music festivals. But the word got out.
We're talking with Joel McCower. His book is Woodstock, The Oral History. It's been re-released just in time for the 40th anniversary, which is a couple of weeks away. You can download the audiobook at audible.com or go to Joel's website for more information at woodstockoralhistory.com. We'll come back and talk more in a moment as the Dave Ross Show continues with Paul Harris on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. Southpaw guitarist named Jimi Hendrix from his closing set at Woodstock 40 years ago, which of course included that legendary version of the Star Spangled Banner as well as this version of Hey Joe. The list of people who performed at Woodstock was remarkable. I love the fact that before Jimi Hendrix took the stage, the last act before him was Sha Na Na. Boy, if you look through the history of rock and roll and said, pick two people who are not alike at all, I think Sha Na Na and Jimi Hendrix would be the ones. Also there, Richie Havens, Ravi Shankar, Arlo Guthrie, Joan Baez, Country Joe, John Sebastian, Santana, Canned Heat, Mountain, The Grateful Dead, CCR, Janis Joplin, Sly and the Family Stone, The Who, The Airplane, Joe Cocker, 10 Years After, The Band, Blood, Sweat and Tears, Johnny Winter, Paul Butterfield Blues Band, and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, who of course did that legendary version of Woodstock, a song written by Joni Mitchell, who wasn't even there. We're talking with Joel McCower, whose book is called Woodstock, The Oral History, which you can get more information on by going to woodstockoralhistory.com. What's the story of Joni writing a song about an event she wasn't even at?
Well, the sad truth for Joni is that she was supposed to be there, and there was a... she was supposed to come, but she was also supposed to do the Dick Cavett show I forget which night, Friday night or Saturday night, and so she stayed behind in New York and in New York City, and therefore didn't make it. So I don't know, you know, why she of all people ended up writing the song. I guess she was inspired, as you know, songwriters often do, to write that. But and that became the anthem, and you know, actually created in some ways the myth that there were a 500,000 people. You know, by the time we got to Woodstock, we were a 500,000 strong. I don't think it was quite a 500,000. I think it was more, you know, most of the estimates are slightly under that. But, you know, that clearly became part of the story.
In the last segment, Joel mentioned a guy by the name of Wavy Gravy. We'll talk about him in a second, but I want to play a piece of audio from your oral history and from the audio book that's available on audible.com right now, of Wavy Gravy talking about how he and some friends were there, and one of their roles was to help people who are having bad acid trips. Roll that.
I remember when the first guy came in, there's these five doctors in white coats and shirts and ties, and me. And this guy comes in screaming, Miami Beach, 1944, Joyce, Joyce. And this 300-pound Australian doctor lays down on top of this guy and says, body contact. You need body contact. And the guy's screaming and moaning and going, Miami Beach, 1944. And this psychiatrist leans in and says, just think of your third eye, man. And the guy's going, Joyce, Joyce. So I figured it was time for me to make my move. I said, excuse me, I'm going to make my move. And they all backed away. What's this hippie going to do? And I go in. He says, Miami Beach, 1944. I says, what's your name, man? He says, Joyce. I says, what's your name, man? He says, 1944. I says, what's your name, man? He says, Bob. I said, your name is Bob. And you could just see the lost hotels float out of his eyes, you know. I says, your name is Bob, your name is Bob, your name is Bob. And he's getting it, and he's getting it, and he's getting it. And when he's got it, I say, guess what? He says, what? I said, you took a little acid, and it's going to wear off. He says, thank God. Because they don't want to know about third eyes. They want to know they're going to come down.
That is Wavy Gravy, one of the people that Joel McCower interviewed for his oral history of Woodstock. Who was Wavy Gravy?
Well, Wavy Gravy wasn't even called Wavy Gravy at Woodstock. He gained that name. He was actually named that a couple months later at the Dallas Pop Festival by, of all people, B.B. King. But he was a fellow named Hugh Romney who had originally was a stand-up comic. And he and his wife, Bonnie Jean Romney, who I also interviewed, actually had a little commune that they called the Hog Farm, so-called because it started in L.A., and some guy who had a hog farm said, look, stay in my land if you take care of the hogs. And eventually they moved to New Mexico, and it was there that one of the organizers of the Woodstock Festival found the hog farm and said, you know, we need a group to come and help the city kids cope in the country. You know, the people aren't going to be prepared. They're going to make goofy fires and aren't going to be right. They're not going to have enough food to eat. So they came and they flew out on this, you know, they basically this commune was flown out on this chartered American Airlines Astrojet, and it's a whole story about how all that happened and some suspicions that even the pilot might have accidentally drunk the wrong Kool-Aid before the flight.
Huh.
And they ended up being quite heroic in terms of creating this free kitchen where they were feeding tens of thousands of people every day who just simply didn't have enough food there. But they also created, as Wavy described, this trip tent where the doctors that were there didn't really know how to deal with kids who were having bad LSD trips, and they, you know, Wavy and his group really had a great way of doing that. Part of the ingenuity of Woodstock was that there was just amazing creativity. There was a guy named Wes Pomeroy who was 50 years old. He was the head of security. He had actually come out of the Nixon Justice Department, but he had this Buddhist mentality for maintaining order. So that when they heard, for example, that the Hell's Angels were coming up the highway en masse to attend Woodstock, they met them as they approached and hired them all as messengers and sent them off, scattered them in 50 different directions, so that they got absorbed in the crowd. So they had this great way, the hog farm, the security people, and that was really part of the miracle of Woodstock.
When we come back, I'll ask Joel about the alleged Woodstock baby, about the rumor that Pete Townsend beat up Abby Hoffman at Woodstock. And did anybody make any money on this? Joel McCower's book is Woodstock, The Oral History, online at woodstockoralhistory.com. I'm Paul Harris, doing the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. The 40th anniversary of Woodstock is a couple weeks away. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for Dave Ross, and talking with Joel McCower, author of Woodstock, The Oral History. And with Janis Joplin in the background, I got to ask Joel about a couple of enduring Woodstock myths. For instance, Joel, whatever happened to the Woodstock baby? Was there a baby born at Woodstock?
You know, Woodstock gave birth to an Oscar-winning movie and lots of songs and CDs and lots of great stories, but no baby. I just researched it. I talked to doctors and cops and hospitals and all the healthcare people. No one's been able to come up with a baby. There is a movie coming out, an Ang Lee movie, in a few weeks called The Road to Woodstock, and the guy whose story is based on claims that he helped deliver a baby outside the festival at his family's motel. It's still unclear about that, but none born at the festival.
Okay. What about the rumor that Pete Townsend beat up Abby Hoffman at Woodstock?
Well, it's not a myth. I mean, people witnessed that and photographed that. Abby had the need at one point, and he was, I think he was hallucinating or on some substance, to jump up on stage. He was sitting by the stage, and he jumped up there during the Who's performance to talk about a political cause, a guy named John Sinclair, who had been inappropriately jailed for many, many years for a small possession of marijuana and had become a cause celeb. He got up to talk about John Sinclair. Peter Townsend basically boinked him with his guitar, knocked him off the stage, and Abbey went off into the crowd. And to his dying day, and I interviewed Abbey for the book, he disputed the story, but lots of people saw it.
Did anybody make money off of the Woodstock concert?
Well, mostly Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers, you know, there had been this crew that had put together this money for the stage, for the film, and they signed, really, Warner Brothers kind of signed the deal on stage, and some people kind of claim they stole it. Nobody really made any money except the guys who invested in the film and everything sort of got their money back, and a lot of the musicians and producers are still bitter. Two of the four producers, a guy named Joel Rosenman and a guy named Michael Lang, still have a company called Woodstock Ventures, Inc. They're trying still to this day to have a new Woodstock festival. They're still trying to make money. Nobody, you know, they've made a little bit of money, but it never really was the great profit-making center, except for Warner Brothers.
Well, there was a Woodstock festival 30 years later, and there have actually been a couple of Woodstock concerts since, but those were much more corporate and nothing like the original, right?
Yeah, you know, people ask, will there be another Woodstock? And no, there will be something called Woodstock someday, but, you know, you can't have another Woodstock unless you have another 1969. It's kind of like, you know, getting four guys together, three guitars and a drummer, and calling themselves the Beatles. Sure, you can call it that, but it's not the same.
I think that's a great analogy. I'm also curious about the bands who performed there. And I know you talked to Joe Cocker, you talked to Paul Kantner of the Airplane, and Richie Havens and David Crosby. Did any of these guys think that they were at their musical best there? Crosby, by the way, he and Stills and Nash and Young, that was their debut, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. And I mean, it definitely propelled a lot of careers. Country Joe McDonald, for example, with his famous so-called fish cheer, give me an F,
yeah.
You know the rest. But the fact is that most people, Jerry Garcia, for example, said, we were terrible at Woodstock. The conditions for musicians were so bad in terms of the logistics, in terms of the sound system, in terms of everything else, that they were lucky they got any notes out. But, you know, and Jimi Hendrix played his iconic Star Spangled Banner. Janis Joplin had an amazing performance. But they did this against all odds. Richie Havens, you know, the song Freedom that he did, he was the first guy to play because there was no one else, you know, who could even make it to the festival because of the traffic. He ran out of songs. He sang everything he ever knew. They kept him on the stage, so he made up Freedom on the spot. Great moments, but, you know, they weren't necessarily the epitome of their careers.
This is the book to read to find out about Woodstock. It's called Woodstock, The Oral History by Joel McCower. You can find out more about the book by going to his website, woodstockoralhistory.com. You can also download the audio book on audible.com. Does that include some of the audio of your interviews with these people?
Oh, exactly. It's a two-hour documentary that includes the voices of Abbie Hoffman and Wavy Gravy and Joe Cocker and a bunch of the musicians and all the producers and on and on.
It's great stuff, Joel. Pleasure talking to you again. Thanks.
Likewise, Paul. Thanks.
Joel McCower here with Paul Harris doing the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.